had a lovely warm welcome already. The applause, thank you. Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Geelong Library and Heritage Centre. A cold night, isn't it? Befitting the winter solstice. My name's Patty Morales, and I'm the Chief Executive Officer of the Geelong Regional Library Corporation. To begin this evening's event, I want to acknowledge the Wadawurrung traditional owners of this land, their elders past and present, and all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people who are part of this region's community today. And welcome everyone to Level 5 of the Geelong Library Heritage Centre. This level is named Wurdiyuang in Wadawurrung language, and it references the Yuyangs, a significant spiritual site of the Wadawurrung people. And normally, of course, you can see them in the daylight, but given it is the winter solstice, not much hope of that tonight. Now, it's not uncommon for successful authors to overtly or indirectly draw inspiration from their past. Examples include F. Scott Fitzgerald, who vividly depicted the excesses and shortcomings of America's 1920s gilded class, a society he aspired to join. And when she was 10 years of age, Harper Lee's father was a reporter in a local newspaper that covered the trial of an African-American man accused of a horrific crime in segregated Monroeville. Less frequent are authors' reimagined stories, inevitably influenced by the convergence of childhood and major social and political change, culminating in the overthrow of a 2,500-year continuous Persian monarchy. It's extraordinary. Shakufe Azar was born in Iran just 7 years before the Islamic Revolution. She's recounted in recent months her longing for the many wondrous books that once lined the walls of her childhood family home in Tehran. And I was fortunate to have coffee with Shakufe recently in our public cafe downstairs, and we talked about her love of books and libraries, which is really wonderful. A great conversation that I'm very interested in, as you know. Her early interest in literature and art developed into a successful career, including 14 years as an independent journalist. For a time, she edited essays and wrote for children, and her companion in writing and editing essays won the 1997 Best Book in Iran Award. In 2004, she became the first Iranian woman to hitchhike the length of the Silk Road. I didn't know that.
Someone here is evidence of that.
Evidence?
Yes,
oh.
We met each other in Pakistan.
Oh, that's wonderful that you're in the audience.
The first Australian that I met ever.
Oh, that's great. And then just 7 years later, in 2010, Shakufe was forced to flee Iran. A girl who became an author, a young woman who became a political refugee. Today, she lives here in Geelong, and The Enlightenment of the Green Gage Tree is her first novel to be translated into English. It's a book inspired by intriguing, formative experiences, and I'm thrilled that she can join us for tonight's author encounter. Now I'm just going to introduce the other person on the stage with us tonight, who will be in conversation with Shakufe. And it's a great friend of Geelong Regional Libraries, John Bartlett, who experienced his own formative literary moment at the age of 11, when a Benedictine sister admonished him for using big words. He absolved himself of the apparent grammatical transgression and later served as a Catholic priest, working in the southern Philippines for 10 years. Is that right? 10
it's
years.
True.
Here, he immersed himself in the life and culture of the Philippines, its violence, corruption, injustice, and heroism. John says that the experience inspired his first novel, Towards a Distant Sea. John has since written a second novel, Estuary, and a collection of short stories, All Mortal Flesh. In 2017, his non-fiction was collated into an e-book, A Tiny and Brilliant Light, and his crime novel, Jack Ferryman, Reluctant Private Investigator, was released this March. Not bad for a kid using big words. Please join me in extending a very warm welcome to Shakufe and John Bartlett.
Thank you. Thanks so much, Patty, for that lovely introduction, and welcome everybody this evening. A wonderful opportunity to talk about this wonderful book, Shugulfe. The Enlightenment of the Green Gaze Tree, for me, was a great revelation in many ways, not only because of the stories that it told, because of the light it shone on the Islamic Revolution in 1979, but particularly the style of the book, and maybe that's where we could start. It's a style that was certainly unknown to me, and I think to a lot of people this evening, the Persian classical style and Persian literature. Could you say a little bit about the history of that style and where it came from and where it started?
Hi, I'm glad to be here. Yes, Persian classic literature is very deep, actually. I'm very old, and as much as I know, at least it has something like 4,000 years history. We have written books and ancient tablets, you say, ancient tablets, on the mountains and wall and caves. So, the importance of the Persian literature classic is that we deeply, in literature, we use magic realism. So we didn't know this name until South American writers introduced this name to us. But when we see all of the ancient countries and cultures like Iran, India, Egypt, we see same style exactly. It's not because just it's beautiful, they use it because it is beautiful, they use it because they believed. They believe that life doesn't stop after this death. And they thought that somehow we continue to live. And in Iran, it still is like that. Most of people, Sikh people, think that dream has meaning and life never ends after death. And there are so many creatures or whatever that they're living with us, around of us, but maybe we don't see them. So all of these affect on our literature deeply, and still in modern literature we can see these styles come through, and this is why I try to, one of the reasons that I use this style is that.
So the Islamic Revolution didn't get rid of that tradition, the Persian literature, it still survived.
So actually, they are all of them are very uneducated people. All of government person that I know in Iran are uneducated people. So they don't know and they don't care. So thanks God, I'm glad, because if they know, definitely they destroy it.
And that whole sort of, what was the revelation to me too, was that whole philosophy of Zoroastrianism. So that's a very ancient part of Iranian culture too, isn't it?
Yes, Zoroastrian is the way, our second ancient religion, that we can call it philosophical religion. And it started, a document says, they are not, they say two things. They say he raised in Iran about 5,000 years ago. Other documents say that he raised about 3,000 years ago. But the main idea of his religion or his philosophy is that there is always there is a good God and bad God inside of us and outside of us, that they all the time they're fighting. And if you are a good person, you try to follow the good God. And also there, this religion, beautiful religion, has three important soligan that says good behavior, good speak, and good talk. So it's that it means if you do these three, it means you are a good person.
So this is really that whole sort of philosophy and style and culture that you've used to tell your story. I was wondering why, because your background was as a journalist in Iran, so you're very much sort of, you know, very much tied up with facts and reality. So why was this magic realistic style for you the right way to tell this story? You didn't take that journalistic way of telling the story.
It had few reasons. That one was the I mentioned, that because of our literature is full of magic realism, and I love that, and I want to somehow show this literature to my world. And another reason is that still people believe ghosts, and people still believe on, you know, interpreting of the dream are very important for people. Even in my family, that all are educated. Most of the morning, we wake up and say that, okay, what you had, what you saw last night, you know, in dream, and try to help each other, what is this meaning? And since 20 years ago, I'm writing my dreams. And after, for example, 5 years or 10 years or 20 years, I found some of them really had meaning to my life. So I found that life is very, very much, what can I say, very much unexpected. And we don't know anything about the life. This is my experience. I found that life is very complicated, very sophisticated. And this is another reason that I choose this style. And also, realistic life in Iran is so harsh. And I think I was not enough strong to face all of that horrible history, modern history, again, throughout my writing in realistic style. I want to add, it was like, I want to explain like that. It was like you want to explain, or you want to picture a darkness, and then you say, no, let me put a moon, and then put some stars, and then put, you know, something that makes this darkness more beautiful. You know, if I want to just show this darkness throughout my style of realistic writing, of journalist writing, I think it was so hard even for me to copy it, and I prefer to make it more beautiful and also show different aspect of beauty of Iranian culture.
Because you've got these two things running at the same time, the reality, and the reality is just, it's terrible. I mean, it reminded me, talking back to that time, 1979, which I sort of vaguely remembered, about what the Islamic Revolution really was. You know, it was terrible, and so many people died. At the same time, you've got this mythology sort of running at the same time. And certainly your story is full of facts. You know, you've got the footnotes often at the bottom, which alert us all the time to the things that actually happened, the terrible sort of things that happened. Is it true to say then that you're sort of putting through the idea that reality and myth is sort of the one thing, there's no sort of separation between the two, that there's this real life happening, but there's this mystical sort of magic life happening at the same time? Is that?
Yeah, kind of. And also I want to show all of different aspects of lifestyle in Iran. You know, in Iran we have really hard, especially women, has really hard life in Iran, but in the same time, we have lots of beauty, you know. It's not fair if you just look at the ugliness of the, you know, your culture. There are so many beauty. So our literature, our art is so beautiful, our music, our poem, it's just breathtaking. Our Persian classic prose is so beautiful. So I just try to mix everything together, while my main idea was telling the truth of history in last 40 years, what happened to us. And I want to show that how much it's affecting our emotions. It's, for me, most important things in life is emotions. Anything that we do in our life, doesn't matter what it is, how much is realistic, how much is, you know, how much is believable, what is that, well, how much we study, what we work, you know, all it's, the only thing that has matter is emotion, I think. And I want to show that this book is history of our emotions. What happened to our emotions when they killed our brothers, when they killed our families, when they all the time treat us like second and third citizen of the city or the country. And it's really horrible, but and then in the same time, as a journalist, I learned a lot from Iran about our society. What is our weak point, you know, weakness in Iran? Why, after this amazing civilization, still we are facing this dictatorship? And is it something wrong with us, you know? And we should find it. We should find what is that. So through this book, I try to show that that this religious government didn't come from another planet. It's come between us, people from us. So I want to just face with that, and I show that this ugliness is part of us. also at the same time, this beauty is part of us.
Mm-hmm. And you may not want to say too much about, you know, life in Iran, but I mean, you operated as a journalist and as a writer for a long time, but what was it like then, sort of operating under that regime?
So, life as a journalist. Mm. So, it's like you go into your office. First of all, you wake up in the morning, and first thing that you should think is you should cover all of your body. So, your head, your body, and every day you say, I don't want it, but I should do. And then you go to a street, take a car or taxi, and go to the board, and then you see the office is closed, it's plumped. And no explanation, what happened? Call to friends, call to co-workers, and what happened? Government closed it. Why? Because of the articles that, for example, you wrote it yesterday. And imagine, what is your feeling? It's horrible that you wrote something that you think is true, but the result is all of your co-workers, they are jobless now. And then they call you, you know. They call you and then start to interrogating you a few times, and then they arrest you, put you in the jail once, and again after 1 week they release you, and again it's happened not just for you, all of my colleagues. In 1 year, in our newsroom was about 40 journalists, and in one day, one night actually, they went to our houses and knocked the door and arrest us, 17 of us. In just in one night. And then why? Because you aren't writing something that we don't like it, and we have red line, and we 100 times emphasize that this is our red line, what you put your feet, you know, after this red line, why you did that. So it's all the time happening. I remember 1 year, four office of us, four different newspapers, closed by government. And when it's closed and plumped, we start, all of us, our group, start another newspaper. And then after 1 month, they close it again. And it's happened four times a year, so it's really frustrating. And another thing is women, as I remember, and I experienced, women never be copied at all or editor in Iran. We can't be sub-editor. After many years working, with all of our experience, none of the women that I know, journalists, never be copy editor or editor. Why? Because we are women.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to come back to the story of your leaving Iran perhaps in a moment, but we probably should say something about the story itself. I mean, it's the story of a family, really, isn't it? There's the Hushan, the father, Rosa, the mother, Beta, the daughter, and Sohrab, the son. Narrated by the other daughter, 13-year-old Bahan, but it's not quite what we expect, because pretty soon into the story we find that Bahar is really a ghost because she's been murdered, basically, and then she narrates the rest of the story. But it all seemed like suddenly we're in this world where the living and those who had died, they were all together. They were living the same life together. There didn't seem to be a separation between the living and the dead. There's a continuity of life, which I found wonderful, really. So can you say a little bit more about that?
Yeah, actually, I wish life was like that.
So do I.
I miss my father a lot. I wish he was here. Mm. So, and my grandmother. So I think I just try to picture what I loved to be reality. And also, I mean, about the ghost and this kind of stuff. And also, I just present what we believe in Iran. And the family you mentioned, that why I choose this family, the name of Hushang is exactly the name of my father, Rosa is the name of my mother, but it doesn't mean that they really present, you know, the real person. But the father is kind of intellectual who escaped from the result of the Islamic Republic, and he escaped from Tehran to the very remote village because he doesn't want to be involved with this revolution, and you know, lots of execution happened and everybody spy another person. In first decade of Islamic Republic, we experienced really horrible things. I mean, there were no any morality. Everybody spy another person. And I remember our principal at high school, she renamed her sister to the government, and they executed. And it's happened a lot in Iran in the first decade. And this is why people experience fear. And then war started, and again, people involved with the war. And you know, somehow people find it's so difficult to face with this regime. As a member of the a family who don't believe in this regime, or whatever, people who don't like, they are not religious, or they belong to another religion, like Baha'i people, that they face very terrible and injustice, situation in Iran. So life is really sometimes, most of the time, is challenging in Iran. Yeah. And as much as you know, and as much as you you understand the situation, you suffer more. You know, some people don't care a lot. I think everywhere is like that. You know, some people, for example, someone is engineer and his job is engineering. He just want to be engineer. He just want to have income and back to house. He doesn't care about the politics. He doesn't care what happened to neighbor. But when you are aware and when your antenna is working, it's really suffering, I think.
I don't want to sort of dwell on the actual, facts of the Islamic Revolution, but probably should just mention a couple of things that people may not be aware of before we sort of move back to the book. There's what they called the chain of murders between 1988, I believe, and 1998. Can you tell us something about that?
Yes, it was a list, actually, a list of 90 people that intelligence service made that, and they has planned to kill one by one secretly, and they say that it is just kind of normal murdering that happened in all countries or society. But after I think about 8 or 9 of them, people just start to following up, and everybody find it that it is just political murdering, and they killed 8 writers and translators and poets. And just imagine, you kill the poets. In the country like Iran, that the poem is so important for us. And we have 1,000 years of poems, in Iran. And then just kill a poet because he believed to something that you don't believe or you don't agree. Yes, there are so many facts in my novel that is actually base of my novel, core of my novel is on the true stories of politics that happened in Iran, and I was evidence of them, or as a journalist, I involved with them, or I read a lot or I heard.
We're going to actually read a little bit that relates to those 1988 executions later, in a very sort of poetic and beautiful way that you sort of talked about that sort of happening. But I want to go back just quickly. I didn't realise when you talked about Hushang, the father, bore great resemblance to your own father, and I think your own father was a great influence on you in terms of your intellectual and cultural life. Can you say a little bit about him?
Yeah, my father was poet and writer and artist, so in many aspects he affected a lot, impact on us a lot as a child. As a children, we were 5, and 3 of us are writer and poet and translator, so we really, I think we learned from him a lot. And yes, it's the father in this novel, which has the same name of my father, as actually, it's really similar to my father. Yeah.
And that sort of love of books and learning and culture is very central to your story, isn't it?
Yes, it's very important for me. And my family always involved with book and publishing and poets. My grandfather was writer. My grandfather was writer of kingdom. My father was poet, and one of my uncle is very, very well known poet actually. And books were everywhere in my life, and it was most important, belonging that we had, and we loved, we touched it, and we smelled it, and I remember for weeks me and my father sit in his library room to just, you know, sort the books and talk about that. It's just kind of, you know, I think making love with books. Yes, so books are just important part of my life. Yeah, and I want to show that, especially to English readers, that how much Persian literature is beautiful. And I want to show you that it's just something that is beyond of, you know, our politics.
We've spoken about the father in the story, but we probably should say something about Rosa, the mother, too, and the connection to the whole idea of enlightenment in the Green Gage tree. Mm. Perhaps just say something about the Green Gage. Why the Green Gage tree? What's the significance for you?
So actually, I grew up in the garden, a big garden in northern Iran, and that in our garden we had lots of green gage. We call it gorgeous, and I love this fruit, and it's so rare, and it's kind of plump. So it was nostalgia of me from my childhood, and I wanted to show this, and I knew that in Australia no one knows gorgeous apps. No one knows green gage. And then, but it was the, you know, the tree that it by itself, it's blossoms, it's white, and in the spring, the smell of flowers goes everywhere in the village, and it's just beautiful. And this tree, Green Gage tree, is just kind of symbol for me in this book, symbol of tree of life. Mm-hmm.
So it's Rosa, the mother, who's really the one looking for the enlightenment, isn't it? You know, probably as a result of what's happened to her family. Mm. But what's this enlightenment that she's looking for? I think there's one point there where I read, she says that she wanted to see herself from afar. Is that part of the enlightenment? What is it that she was looking for?
Yeah, actually enlightenment, I think, is the spiritual term, that it means you reach the highest level of spirituality, and it means you, in the moment, you experience that you are exactly part of the function of this world. And every spiritual person has this experience in different ways. And it is interesting if I tell you that after all of politics and horrible things that happened to us, spirituality raised in Iran a lot. And I think it was kind of psychological escape from the reality. You know, reality was so harsh, and it still is harsh, and people find that mysticism is really the things that they really can escape. And Osho, Buddha, and you know, Iranian mysticism, and all of these are very popular in Iran. And also my uncle, one of my uncle is very experienced of, you know, he's very experimental of this. And for many, many years, I remember that he practiced meditations, and so we had lots of conversation. And opposite of my father, my uncle, from my mother's side, my father was a very materialist person, you know, a person who didn't believe God, who didn't believe in spirituality, and he just believed on fact and science. And I remember so many discussions between them, and this is why I choose, you know, this kind of different opinions about the life in this book.
And just going back to the Green Gage tree, I think I heard in an interview somewhere, I think it was with Philip Adams, you said you found green gage trees in Geelong.
I found in Geelong two trees. It's just interesting.
Are we allowed to know where they are?
Follow me. Green gage tree, follow me.
Are we allowed to know where they are, or is that a secret?
No, yes, it is in, what's the name? In Geelong West.
Oh, great.
Yeah, it is in summer, next summer. I will show you.
Now, you do seem very, well, naturally very critical of society, and towards the end of the book, about the social media obsession with a lot of people, and I think you talk a bit about the collapse of Iranian culture, and talk about the intellectual midgets. So it seems like you're sort of, you said before that the leaders of the revolution are not very intelligent or very intellectual. Mm-hmm. Is that still the fact?
Yes, exactly. You know, when Islamic Republic happened, immediately after that, they did a referendum. And they asked people, do you want Islamic Republic of Iran or you don't want? And 98% said, yes, we want. But they didn't know they vote to what. They just thought, okay, this is kind of a spiritual, you know, religion nice and soft and gentle religion, plus the population, but none of them happened to us. But the point is, immediately after the Islamic Republic happened, the very, very uneducated people and harsh people from around the cities with poor families, they got power. Because their slogan was, this is a revolution of the poor people. They call it Mostaz Afin. So, and then poor people with no education, with no significant background, they got power, they got great job, and educated people fled from Iran, or they've been jobless. And I knew lots of Iranian lecturer at university in first decade. I knew that they work as a driver because they were jobless. So it's still the same. And the funny thing is, the children of that people who are in the power now, they have education, but their mind is still the same because they're following their parents. So still power is in the hand of this kind of people. And of course, you can imagine that how much intellectuals suffer in this system.
Just going back then to your own story, we are celebrating Refugee Week this week. You did come to Australia as a refugee. Can you just say a little bit about how you left and how you came to Australia?
Yes, so the last time that I've been arrested in Iran, and then my mother and my older sister actually really encouraged me to just leave Iran, because if I want to stay in Iran, it would be continue, they could arrest me. So I went to Turkey, and then I thought I want to go to Europe, because all of journalists who fled from Iran, they went to Europe and America. And I had no idea about Australia. So, but when I went to Turkey and I found this a very long way, and I had, my money was very limited. And I found someone introduced a smuggler to me, and he said, "No, there is another way, but it is so risky. And you can go to Australia by boat." So I choose to come, sorry. And then I came here, and I came to Christmas Island. I was 5 days in boat, a roofless boat, very horrible situation with 74 other people. And then I've been in the Christmas Island only 1 month, because 5 days being in the boat made me very sick, and they thought I have TB. I had lots of cough and blood and these kind of things. And they immediately transferred me to Perth Royal Hospital, I think it was Royal Hospital. And then they again put me in the solitary room. I think it is my destiny to all the time go to the solitary room. But it was only 7 days, and it was for my health. And but thanks God, they found it is not the TB, and they released me, and I be in the camp more 6 months. And they, because they found all of my backgrounds as a journalist in internet, so they gave my PR after 6 months, and then so I became a asylum seeker.
And we're glad that you came to Australia, because I think that. I think that this book is a gift to Australian literature. I think it's wonderful to see literature in Australia moving in these other directions and picking up, you know, the stories of people. You did say something interesting, though, about the refugee idea. I think you said somewhere that your story is not about surviving as a refugee, but as a person. Do you remember saying that? I heard it on an interview somewhere. Is that...
You're talking,
well, but it's, you're not concentrating on, it's the refugee survival story. It's about, as a person, as a human being,
yes.
Surviving.
Is yes, exactly. Correct? So I was so depressed when I came to Australia. I didn't want to go to any countries. And I miss my country a lot. And as you can guess, I'm not able to back to my country. So I was so depressed, and I had no in English language. Still, my English is horrible. My English teachers are there. And they know that how much is challenging for me. But anyway, the only thing that I had was my life, my experience, and what I believe, and my knowledge and my skills of writing. So I said, just sit and write. And this book actually was my healing. And when I finished it, I said, yes, I did it. And then I feel, okay, no more depression, just sit and work and learn language and then try to publish it. Publishing of this book was very hard. Perhaps it's your next question, I will tell you now.
That was about translating. Yeah. Finding a
translating also was hard. I asked to one of my American friends that she really knows Farsi very well. She lived in Iran for many years. I asked her to translate first few chapters, and then I tried to send to publishers and see if I can find publisher or not. And then for 1 year, I just sent to big publisher and medium-sized publisher. No one cared at all. Or I had, actually, I think I had one or two feedback that they said, wow, it is amazing book, but it's not our type. And then in the end, I sent to Wildingo Press in Melbourne, which is very small publishing. And after 2 weeks, she said, I love this book. And I'm really surprised. But the process of publishing still was long because she should pay thousands of dollars to my translator. So she paid something like $15,000 to my translator, our translation translator. And so it was a big decision. And she didn't want to do this risk until she found, in the Frankfurt Festival, I think, she found that her book agency found that there are so many countries that they are interested in this book, and then she made the decision to publish this book. So it was really hard, and it took me, the whole process of writing and translation and publishing took me 5 years.
And I understand you're working on another book.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm. Okay. Yeah, there will probably be some questions in a little while too, and Shukri, you've asked me to read a piece from your book, but I was sort of saving one of the big questions that I think I said that I might ask that probably can't be answered this evening, but I just wanted to ask you, you know, reflecting on living in an autocratic society, a very cruel autocratic society. If you could reflect on the world that we live in at the moment, which is in many ways is changing so quickly, we only have to look at various countries around the world, look to America or to Hungary today. There were stories about people helping refugees being put in jail, and then even to our own country, to the cruelty of our own government towards certain groups of people. How do we as individuals survive in that sort of world? What should we do in this very fast changing world?
So we can ask ourselves that we just want to survive or we can do something. So I try to survive and also I try to do something through my writing. But people have different skills, people have different, you know, ability. Anyone can find somehow to change the situation. Always I say that the things that now we evidence in Middle East, half of these horrible things that happen in Middle East, including my country, it's raised from our ignorance or being very biased on religion or these kind of things in Middle East. But half of others comes from Western countries that they want our energy. But what we can do, now I am a citizen of Australia. What we can do? We can follow up at least what really Australian government doing in Middle East, what American government doing in Middle East. We read newspaper, but we don't see any news about that. Who knows where resource, energy come from? Who knows what is the deal between Australian government, German government, American government, English government, England government, with the Iraq, Syria, and Iran. We should know, we should follow this, and we should react. I think this is the kind of thing that we can do.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you for that. We're going to ask some questions in a moment, but Shuk, if it has asked me to read a part of her story, and the background of this piece does relate to the deaths, the executions of the intellectuals in 1988, is that right? And describes in a very beautiful, poetic way the tears of those people who died, how they came together and they actually washed into the house of the Ayatollah Khomeini and, well, washed him away, really, didn't they?
So this is my revenge.
This is the background to that. I've got the right part. The city streets became empty. The smell of warm food filled the air, and the muffled sound of nighttime talk filtered out from the windows. Suddenly, the ghosts felt so sad that their constricted throats burst open. Walking north from Vanek Square, 5,000 miserable ghosts began to cry. They cried, and they cried, and they cried. They cried because they missed eating dinner with their loved ones. They wanted herb stew, meat, and eggplant stew, and Barbary chicken. They missed the carefree laughter alongside their families, their kisses and good nights. Their tears flowed and flowed until they turned into a torrent. Here and there, passers-by who had missed the last buses looked up at the star-filled sky and wondered where the deluge was coming from. It was only the homeless addicts and vagabond lunatics whose inner eyes saw that the river of tears was proceeding up Valissa Street, flowing ahead of 5,000 despairing, crying ghosts marching like a vanquished army, occasionally leaning against old plane trees and keening in a funeral lament. The flood worked its way up, reached Tajis Square and Jamaran Street, crossed the bridge over a dry riverbed and flowed under the feet of plainclothes officers. It entered the courtyard and ascended the steps, soaked the rugs and made its way directly to Ayatollah Khomeini's bedroom, where it climbed up the feet of his twin bed and reached him as he lay in a fitful sleep at 2:32 in the middle of an ordinary summer night. He was having his usual nightmare. He was dreaming that thousands of family members of people executed had surrounded him in Azadi Square and were ripping and clawing at him with such savagery that not even one drop of his blood hit the ground. He woke with a fright and felt the stickiness of his sweat on his fingers, toes and temples. He rolled over, scratched his long, bushy beard, and when he saw that his baggy shirt, mattress and pillow were wet, he sat up with a start. He was afraid it was his own blood that had made everything so wet and slimy. He stuck his finger in the moistness and brought it to his tongue. It was salty and slightly viscous. It didn't taste like blood. It tasted like tears. Frightened, he got out of bed and put his decrepit 80-year-old feet on the wet carpet and sank into it up to his ankles. He groped around for the light switch and flicked it on. Then he saw that his room was submerged in tears. His heart constricted with the fear of death, and he let out a terrifying scream, sending the guards into a panic, bringing the termites who were gnawing away at the wooden ceiling to a standstill and giving fright to some sleepy Eurasian collared doves. 8 usually indolent guards jumped up and rushed into the house with weapons loaded and followed the flow of tears from Ruhollah Khomeini's room all the way to Vanak Square next to the maze of alleyways where addicts and homeless had fallen asleep under house windows with the lingering smell of warm dinners. You got your revenge. Okay, I think we've got some time now for questions.
Oh, my English teacher. I should be quite sorry. I don't want to put you on the spot. But I'm really interested in the technicality of your writing. So you've got the narrative of the family, and then you've got the magic realism weaving its way through. When you were writing, did you write the narrative and then interweave the magic realism, or did the magic realism come as you were writing?
Oh, thank you for the question. I did all together. Actually, this novel, when I wrote this novel, after 3 drafts, I found my language, my tone, and the rhyme that I want to do, and I made decision that I want to do this with magic realism. All happened together like a world flood. or, you know, a kind of explosion that all came together. And I wrote it, you know, the same time that I was writing, I was editing and check the tone, language, magic realism, layers, and everything together. It was very complicated, you know, type of writing, yes.
I enjoy listening to the reading. I thought I'd really like to give this to a copy to my Iranian friends, but are you publishing it in Farsi, please?
Oh, good question. So, you know, as you can guess, you know, this kind of book are forbidden in Iran, and you know, we have the Ministry of Censorship in Iran. So it is not official. Like the official name is Ministry of Guidance and Culture. But their job is really millions of dollars goes to this ministry to just put their line on all of our words and remove our words. So 100% is not possible to publish it officially, but I found a publisher who want to help me to publish it undergraduate in Farsi in Iran. And also my publisher, same publisher in Melbourne, she's going to publish it in Farsi and publish Farsi for Iran and in Australia. Yeah, thank
you. Got a question? No. May I put it on his glasses? Oh, sorry.
I was just wondering about your family. Have you family still in Iran? And how is the regime, I mean, is the regime aware of you here? Are you aware of the regime being aware of you here? And more to the point, how is your family?
So we both are very much aware of each other. So, but my family are safe. And my younger sister, she was journalist, and she had the same situation of me. She fled to Germany, and now she's living with her husband in Germany, but rest of my family living in Iran yet. Yeah, thank you.
Any more questions?
Hello. As you said, in Iran, you have wrote an article that you have seen or you have faced the hardship. If any kind of like that topic you have in this novel, do you have any fear that you're going to face in the future, or your family is going to face any kind of hardship that's in Iran? Or,
you know? Good question, yes. Actually, when I want to make decision that to publish this novel here, I had long conversation with my family, and my older sister especially said, don't publish it. If there is even one, you know, just a small window that you can back to country with this novel, you close this window. But in the end, I knew that I can't back, and I knew that I want to be a literature writer in my whole life, and I made my decision to do this. Yeah, thank you.
I think you said in another interview that when you became an Australian citizen, that a door closed for you, is that?
Not because of citizenship, because no. I was in the jail in Iran, and if I back to Iran again, I would be in the jail. And after this novel, 100%.
Yeah. No more questions? Oh yes,
that lady.
Sorry, I've already had one question, but if no one's very keen to ask another one. There was some discussion which I didn't quite, I'm not quite clear about thinking as a refugee or as a human being. And I thought that's a false dichotomy, because I also, as a child, was a refugee. And for me, you know, a refugee is a human being first. The status of being a refugee is a transitional thing. It's something people have to deal with and have to come through, but their humanity is what is
vital. Yeah, but my point of view is that Shukufe is a refugee, that she want to carry this name, refugee, all the time, everywhere that she goes. or she's a human that she has a dream and she wanna follow her dream. And for me, I don't focus on my background as a refugee. I focus on my background as a writer, as a journalist, as a, what I choose to be. Refugee was my choice.
Mm. Part of your life.
Part of my life, yeah.
But you don't want to wear that label forever. It's not a label you want to bear forever.
Yeah.
In some ways, it is something to be proud of. Something that is part of what you've been through it. You've achieved the passage.
I understand, but at the same time, you look. There are so many Iranian journalists who they made decision to stay in Iran, and they faced that regime. I think they are true heroes. Yes. I'm not. I fled. This is what I think about myself. I think all of my co-workers who are still in the jail, who are still has a problem, but are still working as a journalist, they are here.
Well, I think I'm probably speaking for everybody this evening to say that we're pleased that you fled to us and that yourself and your gift of writing is something that we will benefit from. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Kofi and John, thank you both. It's been a really wonderful evening. Thank you for sharing your story so generously, Kofi, and increasing our awareness really of the beauty and the tradition of Persian literature, as well as sharing your personal story. And John, thank you so much for facilitating such a rich discussion. Oh, it's been a really wonderful evening. It all put up and down those stairs. I also wanted to thank our literary event partners this evening, Dimex, and just in the back there we've got Felix, who's going to sell the novel tonight. If people would like to purchase a copy, and you'll be signing as well, which will be wonderful. I'll be there first in there, and keep one there for me. Be wonderful. And finally, I just want to thank all of you for coming out tonight, cold wintry night, to join us at the local library. Thanks so much for your support and for being here this evening. Thanks everyone.